spoken word poetry. Today's guest, Detroit's Jessica Kara Moore, is a master who has performed in Deaf Poetry Jams and TED Talks alike.
They named me something French, but I preferred Cadillac. They didn't invite me to the naming ceremony, but they must have felt my steel body longing for rubber against the ground. I was reborn the Motor City, a beautiful city across the street from another country, inside a thumb, surrounded by Great Lakes.
I'm Jabulani LaFall, and on today's Central Standard, we'll first speak with another master of language, South African author Zakes Imda. His new memoir, Sometimes There Is a Void, is receiving critical acclaim.
The oral tradition plays a very big role in my work, because even to this day, it plays a very big role in the lives of the characters that I write about.
That's all ahead on Central Standard after this hour's news. Good morning, Kansas City. This is Central Standard. I'm Jabulani LaFall. Today we welcome wordsmith Zakes Imda from South Africa, and later in the show, Jessica Kara Moore from Detroit, each with their own story to tell, each with their own style, steeped in the oral tradition of the African diaspora. Zakes Imda, welcome to the show. He joins us with his latest memoir about life in apartheid South Africa and the relationship between East and West. The book is called Sometimes There's a Void. He'll be speaking at the Central Branch of the Kansas City Public Library on Thursday, February 16th at 6 p.m. Mr. Imda, welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hello. You just completed your new memoir, as I mentioned, Sometimes There's a Void. You've told many stories in your lifetime. At what point in your life did you decide you wanted to tell your story?
Well, you know, I never thought I would write an autobiography. And I stress here autobiography rather than memoir. Because, you see, this book is really about my life and my time, the life and times of this particular author, namely Zakes Imda. I never thought that I would write a memoir. I'm a novelist, you see, and that's what I do. But then people have been asking me, you know, over the years, please write, you know, about your life. Because we know, you know, in bits and pieces from articles and so on, that you have led a very interesting life. You are from a very prominent family in South Africa that has been highly involved in the political struggle and so on. And we are also keen to know, you know, those things that made you into the artist you are. But I've always resisted that, you know. Why? Because I knew that I had too many skeletons in my cupboard.
So what made you finally decide to do it, Mr. Imda?
Well, what made me finally decide was that I came to a realization that, well, in fact, I do have stories to tell about my life, and besides, you know, the fiction, you know. And I think many people can learn something from what I have to say. Another thing, of course, was that, you know, the older you get, you know, you become forgetful. I was beginning to forget some crucial events in my life. So I thought, well,
you might as well write them down, is what you thought.
Definitely. Let me take the plunge. Let me take the plunge and write the autobiography.
Now, your subtitle is Memoirs of an Outsider. Why did you or do you consider yourself an outsider? And what were those skeletons in your past that you mentioned?
Oh, well, those skeletons generally are part and parcel of my life, and they feature in the book there, you see. But let me start with the outsiderness part of it. My outsiderness, you know, is something that I've lived with all my life. I think it is part of what has made me into the artist that I am. I've always been an outsider, even in the family, as I was growing up, you see, I would be on my own doing my own thing, painting. I'm a painter as well, or writing, or composing music. I was an outsider as I was growing up, you know, in the company of friends. In other words, you know, this is a consistent pattern in my life, and I see it as what has contributed a lot, you know, into my art. In other words, I draw inspiration from that outsiderness. In other words, it's a good condition, you see.
So it's almost a double outsiderness. What was it like to grow up in apartheid South Africa?
Well, of course, during the days of apartheid, there was oppression, racial segregation, and so on. So those were horrendous times. But also, of course, there was a lot of violence. Most of it, the violence that emanated from the state against those of us who resisted apartheid, who fought against apartheid. So those were, in fact, very bad times. But in my book, I show also that, in fact, we lived, you see. There was life. There were moments of joy. We created art. We sang. We danced. We had families, you know. So,
that's why it's only sometimes there's a void. Sometimes.
Yeah, sometimes there's a void, yes.
Tell us about your father and your family growing up in apartheid South Africa, coming from a prominent family and being a family of protest in that condition.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
My father was a lawyer by profession. But he was also a political activist. He was a founder and the president of the ANC, you know, the African National Congress,
right?
Youth League, which is today the ruling party in South Africa. But then over the years, he broke away from the ANC and was part of the group that formed the Pan-Africanist Congress in the 1950s. But a significant event in my life was that in 1963, he was arrested.
Yes, and tell us about that night that the police came to take your father away. It's featured prominently in the book. Tell us about that night. Take us to that scene. Set that scene, if you will. What happened?
Well, the night, of course, we were just at home as a family, you know. I think it was just before dinner. My mother was cooking, and the police came and arrested him. We did not know why at the time. We knew that he was a political person, but as kids, we never really knew his activities in any great detail. You know, we just knew him as a father and a lawyer. But then after they took him away to jail, and a couple of days later, he was able to escape and went into exile in a neighboring country called Lesotho. He went there as a refugee. I then later had to join him there. I had to leave South Africa and become a refugee with him.
Why did it turn out that you had to leave, Mr. Imda?
Well, I had to leave, well, for many reasons, one of which was police harassment. You know, I was arrested also for the sole reason of being his son, you see. And from time to time, the police would pick me up from school and take me to the police station for interrogation and all that. So my mother thought that it would be better if I left and joined my father in exile, you see. So that's how then I left South Africa. It was in 1963, I think. when I joined him there. So generally, I spent then most of my teenage years as a refugee in that country.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 FM, KCUR, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm Jabulani LaFall. Our guest is South African poet, playwright, novelist, and now memoirist slash autobiography writer, Zakes Emda. His book is called Sometimes There's a Void. He'll be speaking at the Central Branch of the KC Public Library on Thursday, February 16th at 6 p.m. Mr. Emda, you mentioned as a child you reproduced Bushman paintings and then later sold paintings. You're a writer and a painter. What is it about painting in particular that strikes you?
Well, I've always been a painter, you see. It's just, you know, a gift that that I had and that I later developed, of course, through further training, you know, at university when I did a fine arts degree and so on. Painting is one of the activities, you know, the artistic activities that I do, you know, in addition to writing and music. And my approach to those arts in general is a very integrated one. I don't compartmentalize these activities. To me, art is art is art.
So it's a pervasive
my
approach.
Painting, right. For instance, my painting informs my writing. I draw from the experience of painting to create some of the images in my writing. My music informs my writing as well because the rhythm, you know, that one can hear when one reads my stories is informed by music. But on the other hand, music informs my paintings, paintings informs the music. So there is that relationship that that happens, you see, in these arts.
How does your art reconcile the differences between East and West, the colonized and the colonizer, with your South African background and your diasporatic background?
Well, my art does not consciously try to reconcile, you know, any of that. But invariably it will, even if I don't consciously go out of my way to try and do that. Because obviously, having lived in South Africa for many years, having studied in Europe and lived in England for many years and also in America here for many years, I draw from the cultures of all those places, you see. Of course, predominantly my art will be African. But then African that draws from other cultures as well, because you see, I've spent many decades in other cultures. In the book we are talking about, in Sometimes There Is a Void, for instance, since it traces my life, you know, up to this point, a big chunk of it is set in the United States here, you see. And it comments, of course, on various issues of my life here in this country.
It reminds me a lot of Mark Mathabane's story, Coffer Boy, and then Coffer Boy in America, how you look at the differences culturally, yes, and the similarities culturally in segregation here in America, the Jim Crow legacy here in America, and the apartheid legacy in South Africa. How much of your work is based on making a statement, and how much of your work is based on telling a story?
Well, you see, during the days of apartheid, when we used art as a weapon against apartheid, the message was the predominant thing. In other words, if I wrote a play, I approached it from the perspective of what function is it going to serve in the war against apartheid. So, invariably then, that kind of art would be agitprop. The message would be the key thing about it. But Since then, I've realized that to create art that has a much longer life, in other words, art that lives beyond the occasion, one really needs to focus more on the story.
Right.
In other words, it must not be an issue-based story or painting or music or whatever, you see. If it's a story, for instance, the key thing there is the story, you know, your characters, the setting, and what the story is about. And whatever message is there, you know, will organically emerge from who these characters are and, you know, as a result of their interaction and of their environment as well. So, to answer your question then, I would say, for me now, the key thing is the story, much more than it would be the issues which are addressed there. The issues will always be there. If you read my novels, the issues will be there because they are part and parcel of, you know, the lives that I'm writing about. But the approach was through the story. I got to those issues through the story.
You said, Mr. Emda, that storytelling folklore is very important in your work. How do you infuse that across literary genres? You do poetry, playwright, yes, novel, and now the memoir/autobiography. How do you infuse that storytelling folklore background so prominent in African art?
Yes. That's the beauty, in fact, of my culture, is because, you see, it's a culture that's very strong in the oral tradition. You know, those stories that have been passed from generation to generation to generation. Now, when you read my novels, you'll find that the oral tradition plays a very big role in the mode of storytelling itself. And I also found that when I wrote this autobiography, Sometimes There Is a Void, I drew from what I learned from the oral tradition. Let me give you an example. The tone of that book, you see, the rhythm of the language, you find that I adopt a very conversational tone, as if I'm actually telling the story rather than you reading it, you see. That comes from the oral tradition. But also the form itself, the structure of that story, where I shuttle between the past and the present, which sometimes confuses, you know, some of the readers here who may not be used to that mode of storytelling. That also, you know, comes from some of our oral traditions that use that method of storytelling.
Whereas the different approach you use in, for instance, your novel Ways of Dying, where you have a story told through the eyes of a professional mourner who just goes around mourning,
yes,
different funerals, and that's told through his eyes. And you actually use literary device versus the process of sitting on a stoop and relaying a story of what happened in the oral tradition. Talk about the difference in that.
Certainly, but even in that novel, even in Ways of Dying, actually, you can hear the sound of the oral tradition. For instance, the point of view, by and large, that I've adopted there is the communal voice, the we, you know. We did this and this. We saw this character doing this and so on. In other words, the story is told by the community. It has that gossipy voice, you see, of the community. And that gossipy voice of the community comes very much from the oral tradition.
Do you have different goals when you're writing a poem versus a play versus a novel or as opposed to an essay? Are there different approaches that you take?
Certainly. There are different, you know, processes, actually. Because with a poem, of course, it's something that comes immediately and you put it down. And maybe later on you may, you know, doctor it here and there. So it's a one-off sort of thing. Whereas, you know, with novels, it's a long process, and therefore the approach there will be different as well. But in all of my storytelling, novels, including that memoir, the story is told once and for all. In other words, I don't go through the process of rewriting over and over again, you see. I capture the story as it comes, and I put it down in the same way I would be doing if I was telling it to somebody, and the story is told. The only thing that will happen there is just a minor editing here and there, you know. And so that is how my process is, and that process is actually informed by the oral tradition as well.
And as is the music that you compose and do, and you've long had a love affair, what you call a love affair, with the music of Antonin Dvorak and John Coltrane. What strikes you in particular about these two artists, and how do they influence you in your work?
Well, you see, I was introduced to John Coltrane through A Love Supreme.
Right.
Which up to this day, you know, I find it very inspiring. Every time I hear it, oh, that's why I don't play it actually anymore. Every time I hear it, there's that tinge of nostalgia in me.
And there's a build-up. There's a build-up in that percussion as well.
Yeah, you see, that tinge of nostalgia, and then there are tears in my eyes, you see.
What does it remind you of?
Well, you see, it takes me back to the past and some of the past that I write about in the novel there, you see. Because that past, even though it was during the days of apartheid, it was a past that was full of song and laughter. And song, in most cases, was jazz, you see. A lot of American jazz that we grew up listening to it. In fact, in South Africa, you know, black people in the cities of South Africa listen to more American jazz than Americans do.
Yeah, yes. definitely, especially in the modern era. Yeah.
Even today, I mean, we still talk of Charlie Parker, of Eric Dolphy, and so on. People that you don't hear Americans talk about anymore, we still listen to those. In addition, of course, listening to the contemporary guys like Wynton Marsalis and so on.
Mr. Emde, what was it about jazz that struck a chord in the townships and in the shanties and in Soweto and in Lesotho and Johannesburg during that era that you grew up with? What was it particularly about jazz?
Well, you see, one wouldn't know really, because when we were born, our parents were already listening to jazz, you see. And therefore, we grew up listening to jazz. We internalized jazz. We also had our own, I think it's because it was also very close to our own indigenous kind of music. Because we do have South African jazz, you see, which is mostly informed by the traditional music of the various ethnic groups of South Africa. You see, but when you listen to that jazz, and actually when you listen to the original traditional music, you can hear, in fact, you know, that it is quite, it is related to jazz. It is related to American jazz, you see. There are those elements in it that will remind you of American jazz, you see. So I think because, I mean, that's why then it resonated with us.
How is your work influenced by other artists?
Well, my work, well, I'm sure it is influenced by other artists. one way or the other by other writers, for instance, although I may not go out of my way, you know, to be influenced by them, but even subconsciously, you know, I mean, I read a lot and I love writers like Gabriel Garcia Marquez, for instance, Vargas Llosa, and so on. A lot of those South American writers, but I also like writers like Salman Rushdie and all that.
These are very heavy, heavy writers, Salman Rushdie and Gabriel Garcia Marquez. Very dark subjects. Very strong language.
Well, very beautiful language.
And very beautiful cadence of that language.
Yeah, you know, very, very musical language. Maybe that's why I like them as well. Marquez is very ornate, you see, in his language, in addition, of course, to his magical realism. And incidentally, Marquez, who I've been with some time back, told me that his own stories, his own magic realism, actually comes from the stories that his grandmother used to tell him. So you see, he's influenced by the oral tradition as well. Then he asked me, do you know where my grandmother got her stories? I said, well, I don't know. He said to me, my grandmother got her stories from the African slaves in Colombia. So you see, my source of magic, that's what he was telling me, is the same as your source of magic. It goes back to Africa, you see. So I think that's why perhaps I have this affinity to his writing. You know, even before I knew that his sources were African. But then, of course, he told me that African, indigenous Native Americans of South America, you know, Amerindians, those are his sources as well. And, of course, his Spanish heritage as well, you see. So the combination of those, gave birth to his magical realism. My magical realism also comes from those sources, you know, from the oral traditions of Africa. But it also comes invariably from other writers, you know, from the writers of Europe, of South America, of the United States as well, you know, the Toni Morrisons of the world, you see, who actually set some of her wonderful stories in Ohio here, you see. Ohio, which is a very rich field of some of these stories, of the oral tradition as well, because there is very rich oral tradition in Southeast Ohio. My novel, Sion, which is set in this region, draws from that rich oral tradition, which is the same oral tradition that Toni Morrison drew from in Ohio here.
Speaking of oral tradition, we'll be speaking in a few moments with a spoken word poet and performance artist. What do you think of that art form, also inspired by the oral tradition?
Oh, yeah. I love that art form. I'm in awe of that art form. Precisely also because in South Africa now, it is very, very, very big. You know, performance poetry is, we have some of the most wonderful poets, and most of them are women in South Africa. And when there is an oral poetry show, you know, be it some slam thing or you find that it is like a rock concert. Hundreds and hundreds of people who attend these events. So for us, it is a popular event. You know, it's part of popular culture rather than some elitist culture there which is enjoyed only by the elite, you see. It's a very popular form.
Mr. Emda, there's a great surge of art and commerce coming out of Africa these days. What do you see as the future of the continent, beginning with your native South Africa?
Well, I mean, it is a wonderful future. That does not mean, of course, there are no problems. In South Africa, for instance, you see, art has always played a major role, even during the days of apartheid. It was our art that was exported to the outside world. People knew of South Africa because of its playwrights, you know, Bongeni Ngema, Athol Fugard, and so on, because of the writers of South Africa, because of our musicians, you know, and so on. And that heritage, of course, is deeply embedded in South Africa, and it continues. We every generation comes with its own wonderful art forms, you see, some of which from time to time you do see in this country, because we have many of our artists who come over here to perform. I see a very bright future in as far as that is concerned.
Our guest is South African poet, playwright, novelist, and now memoirist, Zakes Imda. His book is called Sometimes There's a Void. He'll be speaking at the Central Branch of the KC Public Library on Thursday, February 16th at 6 p.m. Thank you, Mr. Imda, for joining us.
It is my pleasure.
And after a quick break, we return with poet, publisher, activist, rock star, playwright, actor Jessica Kerr Moore as we continue to explore writing and the Pan-African oral tradition in the next part of the hour with a ladies' flair. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. For this half of the show, we're going to speak with spoken word artist Jessica Kerr Moore. But rather than introduce you to her outright, let's first hear a piece, An Homage to Detroit, from a native daughter, performed at TEDx in Detroit recently.
Homage to Detroit. They named me something French, but I preferred Cadillac. They didn't invite me to the naming ceremony, but they must have felt my steel body longing for rubber against the ground. I was reborn the Motor City, a beautiful city across the street from another country inside a thumb surrounded by great lakes. I was the music made from engines, loud, tough, sometimes just a hum and a hand clap sound. When I grew up, they called me Motown. He is smoking a cool mild. That was his way of slowing down his 30-year-old nicotine habit from me, his second to youngest daughter, who thought he was God and fought for position to be in the front seat of his white, green, or gold Cadillacs.
Welcome to the show, Jessica Kerr Moore. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
How are you? That was a poem, An Homage to Detroit, from a native daughter. You came of age, Jessica, artistically, in the public eye at least, in Harlem at Showtime at the Apollo. Tell us about those early experiences, how they inform your work now, how they launched you out.
Well, you know, the kids that changed my life, you know, of being on the Apollo. That was almost probably 15 years ago now. And it has never left me. I've done a lot of things since the Apollo, but that experience pushed and propelled my career in a way as a poet that I would never imagine possible, to be honest. I'm hoping that you hear me.
I am hearing you very loud and clearly, as did the Apollo audience, which brought you forward. Tell us about that. You mentioned that was almost 15 years ago, but it feels like yesterday, in a sense, that you're still moving those crowds like that.
Yeah, you can't move away from your history, you know, no matter what I've done since then. I've started the press since then and all, you know, done a lot of other television shows and travel. But that experience, I was 22 years old when I did the Apollo, and I didn't realize I was a baby. And I did my poem, Black Statue of Liberty, a poem that I'd written on the west side of Detroit at my girlfriend's house. And when I was hanging out with the last poets, I was only living in New York 5 months. I was still learning the train when I was asked to go on the Apollo and audition. And Maxine Lewis, who actually booked me for the Apollo, strangely enough, was just at Human Bookstore in Harlem with me last week with Danny Simmons. I'm celebrating my 15th anniversary of my press. And it's just amazing how full circle it becomes and how, you know, instead of taking that opportunity, like I won 5 weeks and I was really in a daze because I didn't expect to win.
In a row. We should mention that, in a row.
Yeah, I won 5 weeks in a row, yeah. And then they retired me. It was so funny because that audience in Harlem, you know, is, you know, very, very interesting. It reminded me, I'm very comfortable there on some level because I'm from Detroit. So I was used to performing my work in front of black people from a city environment. So that was like it made sense to perform poems there. But I really didn't expect to win. And then when I won, they didn't know quite what to do with me because the singers that won always had to sing the same song. So I did this poem by Statue of Liberty, then I did it again. And I came out, you know, and the audience doesn't leave. They say they're supposed to leave, and a new audience comes in. But, you know, Black folks, they just moved around. So the people, for the third time, I came out, and Steve Harvey, they're all waiting for me to come out. And I begged to do a different poem. I said, I cannot do the same poem. And so I did Black Girl Juice. I told them it wasn't anything that wasn't appropriate for television. I convinced them of that. And then I won with that and came back. And after 5 weeks, they just retired me. I was getting dressed to come out for my sixth time. And Steve Harvey just told the audience, yeah, we know she didn't lose, but we're going to let her retire. And eventually they made me an Apollo legend. And that was pretty funny. I was sitting out in my house on 159th Street in St. Nick, and I was getting all these phone calls. Like, congratulations. I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, you're an Apollo legend. They just did the whole thing. Kiki sat on the stage. I was like, oh, my God. So life changed quickly. But what's funny about you know, so-called fame and quotes, you know, for me, it made me become more humble. And I know some people, like, lose their minds, you know, when they get, like, 5 minutes. They think they're really special. But for me, it made me work extra harder because I had to prove to the poets that I love, like Sonia Sanchez and Amiri Baraka and Mababa Abiodun and Umar and Gil Scott-Heron, the people who had shaped my work as a little girl, had to make sure that they knew that I had more than two poems.
Right. So, and right. And speaking of which, not only more than two poems, but also the backbone to start a press, as you mentioned, to be a publisher, which is perhaps the behind-the-scenes equally vital title of your many hyphenates. You published a slam poet, Saul Williams' work, before slam poetry was even really mainstream.
Well,
what was that process like?
Yeah, he's definitely not a slam poet, though, for the record.
Right.
And neither am I. And he wasn't then. He was just an incredible writer and poet and still is. And I saw, we were living in Brooklyn at the time. I'd published my first book. I was famous first. And so Saul came over to my house. He hadn't done Slam the movie yet and all that. And so he said, hey, let's make you the high key of our generation. And I was like, oh, that's funny. But I'll publish your book. So I went out the country for a few weeks. And Marcia Jones, who's been an art director for me for many years, and Saul and Marcia Jones have Saturn, their daughter, together. They're just good friends of mine. We're just part of the art scene in New York City in the 90s. And Saul was just blowing audiences away. And that kind of hustler, you know, working class mentality that came from Detroit saw these New York poets and said, wow, these people don't have books. We need to publish books. You know, what's up? And so Saul gave me the Seventh Octave. And the rest is kind of history. I'm 11 books in. I published Raz Baraka's first book of poetry. I published Asha Nadelli, who was someone I looked up to, her second book of poetry after Harlem River Press. Harlem River Press was like the only press that was kind of publishing the young poets, like Tony Medina and Tuhir and Tuhir Hamad and Asha Bandali. And only in the tradition and the New Eureka Poetry Anthology Allowed had been out that kind of represented the poets that were a little older than me. So there weren't a lot of press, publishing houses taking the chance on us. And so I said, you know, we should publish our own voices. And so that's why I started More Black Press. The Words Don't Fit in My Mouth did extremely well, so thousands of copies. From being on the Apollo, people were calling the bookstore saying, I want that poet's book from the Apollo. Where's her book? And that's how I got a distribution deal with Baker & Taylor, because people were calling the bookstores asking for the book that didn't exist yet. And that's how Saul and I became, you know, I did his first book. And after that, did Sharif Simmons' first book, who was considered compared to a Gil Scott-Heron of our generation, did a lot of poetry with music, fantastic writer to this day. And later I've done Etan Thomas with the Center for the Wizards. We worked on Etan's project, 2004, 2005. I published Danny Simmons, who started Deaf Poetry Jam, who's, you know, the oldest brother of Reverend Ron and Russell. And that's a big book for me. That was Daddy's first collection of poetry and his paintings, 64 pages, full-color art book. So it was a big undertaking for me. And this year, I celebrate my 15th anniversary of publishing, and I put out two other poets. I put out one other poet, Shante Legacy Leonard, young poet out of Detroit, because I'm back at home in Detroit working, and Khalid El Hakim, who has this incredible Black History Mobile Museum, and I've published Drum Majors for Justice, which is a really beautiful educational tool for the schools, and it's a book of quotations from 101 African-American politicians who kind of shaped history. So, Yeah, I'm still doing the work. I kind of took a break, but I did. I put out my three books under my press, God Is Not an American, being my newest book.
Tell us about that title. And first, back up and tell us why it's important for blacks, African-Americans, to tell their own stories. And then tell us about that title, God Is Not an American.
Well, it's important for us to be institution builders. And I learned that from my Baba Haki. And I come from a place called Detroit, this city that's built on institutions being ran by people of color. You know, so I came up under Malcolm and Young, and I've been around Broadside Press my whole life as a young poet. Naomi Long Magid, who's our poet laureate, was one of my first mentors as a publisher and poet. And so I came around, you know, black people who believe that literature, you know, that we had a voice. And I was, and if I wasn't for books, I wouldn't know who poets are. Like, this is not New York City. So I wasn't privy to seeing the last poets, to seeing Sonya or Jane Cortez and Lucille Clifton every day. You know, so we had, I found poetry inside books at the library. And into Zaki Shange, because she came, my theater teacher brought her into the classroom. So, yeah, and so that's why I come from books, so I understand the importance of them. And building institutions around are super important, because we don't always get those grants that everybody else gets. And there's not enough grants for people of color. Me and a filmmaker friend of mine were talking about this last night. You know, just there was more things for us to apply to that were specific to, you know, artists that were speaking to our community. And we don't have that enough in this country in general. And as far as God Is Not an American, it's the title of my third book. I think it's my best book. It's God Is Not an American, Poetry, Politics, and Love. And it's a very personal piece, but a lot of my politics, I wrote the piece, and the title was inspired after September 11th, after the World Trade Center. And I have one poem in my second book, The Alphabet Versus the Ghetto, that's about the World Trade Center. And this is kind of about the idea of women of color's voices being left out of the conversation when it comes to global politics. And me thinking, you know, I wanted to write a book of essays, but it had all this poetry still that I needed to get out. I hadn't put a book out in a couple of years, was focusing on other writers, and taking a backseat to my own work being published. And so I decided that I would create a book that spoke to the politics of what I thought about the war, what I thought about South Africa, South African apartheid, what I thought about everything that I'd seen on the planet as far as bombings, what I thought about the Gaza Strip. And I wanted to write poetry that spoke to that, because I feel like as a woman of color, especially a woman of color from Detroit, you know, or urban, you know, so-called urban environment, where our opinions never asked. But when they're bombing the earth and they're killing little children that look like me, you know, and I have to respond to it. So you're not always asked to be on those TV shows or whatever or what have you. And so we have to find... So my book is a vehicle for me to get my voice out there and talk about things that I care about.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 FM KCUR, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm Jabalani LaFall. Our guest is poet, publisher, activist, rock star, playwright, actor, Jessica Caremore. No hyphen, she's all in one. She's performing this Saturday evening along with jazz musician Roy Ayers at the Gym Theater in the 18th and Vine District, an American Jazz Museum event. Now, Jessica, it's February. As you know, what are your thoughts on Black History Month?
Oh, well, I think it's very important that we have it. And whoever says no, they're crazy. You know, I'm busy in Black History Month. I make money during this month, thank goodness. And I get to be in front of, like, Lake Forest Academy. I was just in Chicago in front of, like, a predominantly white affluent school in Illinois, you know, introducing young people to Elaine Brown and Juanita Abernathy through poetry. And so this, unfortunately...
Elaine Brown, we should mention, was the chairperson of the Black Panthers at one point in time. What was missing in our modern discussion? You said women of color didn't have a voice. What was missing in that discussion?
You know, what's missing is our opinions. You know what I mean? Like the fact that we're not looked at as even human enough to have a voice or an opinion about humanity, even though the most of humanity looks like us. You know, and I mean, I had to actually get out of the country to go to Morocco and to go to Brazil and to go to South Africa and these places in Europe where I saw myself everywhere to realize, okay, we have shaped this planet and we're not getting any, you know, no one's asking us our opinion about what's happening to the planet. And that's, and Elaine Brown and Juanita Abernathy and, you know, Kathleen Cleaver, for that matter, these women who sacrificed their lives so that we could just go to school, so that we could have, you know, the Black Panthers who created, you know, the free lunch program. You know, all these things that they did that are not talked about. And unfortunately, places these schools are not still not teaching Black history. I mean, and of course, Black history is just American history, you know, so you would think that it would just be in the books along with everything else that happened. But unfortunately, we still have a racial divide in education, so the artists have to still teach, and we have to continue to be those griots, as the brother was speaking about earlier. Like, it's important that we still have the griots, and we have to still tell the stories, because the education system hasn't caught up to the reality of real history yet. We have a lot to do in this country as far as balancing the scales of what's being taught. And I'm not talking about just for Black children, like white children, the fluent white children in Lake Forest. I said, if you know who T.S. Eliot is and Whitman and Frost is, and you don't know who Lucille Clifton or Sonia Sanchez or Mary Baraka are, and there's a disservice being done to you, and your parents are wasting their $30,000 a year for you to go to this fancy school, because you're still not going to know anything. And you're going to go to college, you're going to go to a good school, and you come out in 4 years, and you're still not going to know anything. And so what's the point of education if our children go through spend all this money with people mortgaging their, you know, their homes so their kids can go to, I spend so much money to send my son just to kindergarten in Detroit, you know, and still, you know, but he will have the information because he has me as his first teacher. And so that's what, you know, Black History Month to me is about, is continuing to educate people who unfortunately are not getting the information. I definitely didn't learn about myself at my predominantly white Catholic school, and I definitely didn't learn about myself at my predominantly Black high school. So it has nothing to do, Black or white, it has to do with the education system being flawed.
It's an ongoing process, in other words. Now, you're performing this Saturday here in Kansas City with Roy Ayers. You a Roy Ayers fan?
Yeah, we performed together many times, and so I'm excited to see Roy again. And we've performed together at SOBs. We've double billed, and anywhere I've kind of been in the audience, he's always put me on stage, and he's one of those great artists like Roy, like Gail, you know, who put the hand out to the other generations and said, here, you know, I want to do some work with you.
What is the correlation between jazz and poetry to you? And what will you bring to this performance on Saturday night?
Well, I'm actually working on a new jazz project. Even though I've been a poet that's been more like a Patti Smith rock and roll artist, I'm actually recording a new project called The Legend of Jesse James. I have a jazz quartet now in Detroit. We premiere next week. And jazz and poetry, like for me, some jazz musicians have looked at me and said, you remind me, the way you speak reminds us of Miles Davis. But you don't take a breath. And the music, like, this is my instrument, is my throat, is my voice. And so even without anything, without a saxophone, I can be a saxophone. You know, and so that's, to me, the connection is very beautiful and very organic. And I'm just excited to be at the American Jazz Museum, a historical place for jazz, and excited to see Roy Ayers and play with him.
Our guest is poet, publisher, activist, rock star, playwright, actress Jessica Caramore, who takes no breaths. She's performing this Saturday evening along with jazz musician Roy Ayers at the Gym Theater at the 18th and Vine District and American Jazz Museum event. Jessica, thank you so much for joining us on Central State.
Thank you for having me.
And tune in tomorrow for The Movie Critics with the Walt Bodine Show and co-host Russ Simmons. Our show is produced by Andrea Salenzi, executive produced by Bill Anderson, with help from Charlie Upchurch. Kim Noble is our announcer. Emily Mutert manages our website. Central Standard's intro theme music is by Miles Bonney. The outro you're hearing right now is by The Will Knots. Up to Date is next with National Geographic photographer Annie Griffiths. I'm Jabalani LaFall. This is Central Standard. Enjoy your day.